Backer interviewing Katie Kerr from the Lansing unit of the Women's Overseas Service League. Today is August 14, 1984. Katie Kerr lives at 941 Lilac and may be located by mail at this address. She's in East Lansing, Michigan, and the zip code is 48823. The telephone number with the area code given first is 517-332-6887. Katie, where were you born?
I was born in Eaton Rapids, Michigan, which is about 20 miles from here. I graduated from high school in Eaton Rapids, went to Albion College, and then I went to Detroit to Grace Hospital, where I spent a year learning to be a medical technician and received my registration as a medical technician, registered medical technician.
What was your maiden name?
My maiden name was Trimble, T-R-I-M-B-L-E. Mm-hmm. After I worked in Detroit for several years, and that was it was during that period of time that I learned that the war, of course, had started. And I became aware of Red Cross and Red Cross girls and some of the activities that they were able to participate in. So from there, I went to Red Cross headquarters in Detroit and asked for an application and sent my application and references to St. Louis, Missouri. Red Cross girls were hired out of St. Louis, Missouri's office, which was the area headquarters. After I went there one day, and actually went there to St. Louis and was interviewed, and came back in the middle of the winter. I remember it was bitterly cold. I was told that they would be glad to hire me, and I was scheduled to start with them about a month or 6 weeks before I did, because during the war, if you were in an essential job, you had to get a release from that job by proving that you had somebody to replace you, and they considered being a medical technician essential. So I remember the frustration that I experienced trying to find somebody to replace me, and eventually I did. So I joined Red Cross in Washington, D.C. on March 6, 1944.
1944, right in the heart of the war.
1944. Mm-hmm. And I was hired as a hospital staff aide. A hospital unit consisted of the field director, the secretary, two recreation workers, and a staff aide. So I trained in Washington, D.C. at the American University for, I believe it was 3 weeks, as a staff aide. It was an excellent training course. Red Cross had hired or had rented whatever it might have been, a part of the American University, and they had an excellent staff. Our duties as a staff aide were to assist most anybody that you could, and also to make out papers for the soldiers who would have related disabilities, service-connected disabilities. I was sent from there to Gardner General Hospital in Chicago, which was down on the beach, I believe, and it was one of the big old hotels down there, but it was called Gardner General Hospital. I was sent there for training before going overseas. While I was there, about 3 or 4 weeks after I was there, I received a telegram saying that they wanted me to come back to Washington and learn to be a hospital recreation worker, which was a step up from where I had been.
What year is this now?
Pardon?
What year?
This is still 1944.
Okay.
This would be April 1944. So I left at Gardner General Hospital in Chicago and went down to Washington, D.C. again. Coming into the big station in Washington was really a thrill, and finding my way around the big city, I felt quite as if I'd really grown from my small town background. I became a hospital recreation worker And that was a 6-week course, a very intensive course, and we covered everything you could possibly imagine in recreation, from crafts to games to dances to giving parties. And we had a very interesting group and some excellent instructors.
Where was your building where you did this?
It was at the American University. This was also, all of Red Cross training was done at the American University. And then we
in
were-
In what city?
In Washington, D.C. Then we were housed in various hotels around town. I remember one period of time I stayed at the Burlington Hotel. And one time I stayed on I Street, E-Y-E Street. And I do not remember the name of the hotel. But anyway, our group in the recreation group became very close, and there probably were 50 in the group. And we'd do square dances, and we'd put on parties, and which was all excellent training for what was coming ahead of us. After I had been there for 6 weeks, we were given our assignment one day. It's a big day because we were to meet the other girls who were going to form our unit. And as I said before, I was assigned to the 110th General Hospital, which was at that time forming in Camp Campbell, Kentucky. This one day we were all to meet our people that we later became such extremely close friends with. The field director was Janet Leahy. The secretary was Jane Hauser, who is now since deceased. The other recreation worker was Florence Friedman, and I was a recreation worker, and our hospital staff aide was Helen Andrews. The five of us formed a quick unit, and it's amazing how quickly you can become close friends and feel like family, and probably within a matter of 2 or 3 days, we were close as sisters. And we were given our papers and our tickets and so forth to go to Camp Campbell, Kentucky. So we took the train, and several other hospital or Red Cross units were also joining their hospital units. And I remember one was in Louisville, Kentucky, which is where we stayed overnight in Louisville, Kentucky. And I remember a Jeep came for them from their hospital and picked them up, and how thrilling it was. And hopefully we were going to have the same experience watching them drive off in the Jeep with the Army doctors taking care of them. We stayed overnight in Louisville and again boarded the train and headed for Camp Campbell, Kentucky. Now it was June, and needless to say, it gets hot down in that part of the country. We got on a train, and there was absolutely no place to sit down, and all the seats were filled. So we stood up and sat on our suitcases, and it's rather strange to think now that a train would be so full that there wouldn't be any place to sit down.
This sounds like Tokyo.
As you remember, well, during the war, it was all the trains were full. One experience I remember on the train was that we girls did notice some empty seats over down the ways, and so we walked down, and sure enough, somebody had their belongings on them, and we sat down there anyway, and sat there quite a while and decided, well, maybe we better not sit here too long, because whoever these seats belong to, we better, you know, they'll be coming back. And so we did. We got up, and later it developed that the men sitting in these seats were doctors from our unit, so medical officers from our unit, and one of them even married a real good friend of mine who I lived with. Anyway, it was interesting to think that these men that we saw early on were later to become friends. We got to our destination, which at that time was Clarksville, Tennessee. Clarksville and, Camp Campbell apparently is right on the borderline between Tennessee and Kentucky. Got off the train in a dirty, dusty depot. And apparently, I remember now, on the train we had met another officer who said he was from the 110th, and he turned out to be the Special Services officer, and his name was George Moorhead. Well, he knew his way around because he was just coming back from a leave or something, and got a Jeep for us, and so he got us all into camp. And if you're not familiar with Camp Campbell, which is now called Fort Campbell, Kentucky, it's a huge, huge military base.
Is that spelled Camp Bell?
Camp Bell, C-A-M-P-B-E-L-L. And it was an armored division, an armored training camp where they trained in tanks and so forth. And so we I do not remember now at this point remember how we got to our billets, but we stayed with the nurses area.
What was this camp like? Barracks or was it?
It was barracks.
Temporary buildings?
Yes. I think most of all of it was temporary. I'm
frame buildings?
Mm-hmm. Yes, just
the bathroom, bath facilities for about 8 people?
No, we lived in the nursing with the nurses, and I don't remember about the bathrooms, except it was pretty substantial.
I see.
I think it was probably much more permanent than some other parts of the hospital were. But it was such a big camp that you rarely walked from one place to the other. And we were...
By big, do you mean several miles?
Yes.
As big as Michigan State University campus?
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. It would be a good comparison. Sometimes we did walk, but usually we were able to get transportation. I suppose we called somebody and called the motor pool and asked them for transportation. We lived 2 to a room, and as I said, this was a nursing area, and I'm sure the nurses weren't all that thrilled to have Red Cross girls sharing their
facilities.
Yes, and. But there were, I guess I should mention at this point that there were, we had joined the 110th General Hospital, which was forming and had been at Camp Campbell for quite some time, getting, I've forgotten the term that they used when you get your, it's a term they use when you're getting everything together and getting ready to move out. But there were only 10 of us girls. There were 5 Red Cross girls whose names I mentioned. There were 2 physiotherapists and there were 3 dietitians. So we were there were 10 girls with 110th General Hospital, and there must have been 75 officers and probably 500 men. And I'm telling you, that was the life. And because we became very special to this hospital group, and we went overseas as just we were the only 10 females that went overseas with this medical unit. When we got over into England, which was our destination.
How did you go? By ship?
Yeah, yes, I'll get that. That's another interesting story. But when we got there, then we picked up the nurses. That was the point I wanted to make. So we were the originals with that unit. We were at Camp Campbell for probably 10 days and did calisthenics. Every morning we got up and had to do calisthenics. And some of the medical officers were our trainers, and I can tell you they weren't all that happy about having to do it.
Katie, did you meet any English people and talk to them for any given length of time?
Oh, yes, we had some opportunity. We had some English women volunteers that would come onto the post, and I think they enjoyed it because I think they, you know, had opportunity to eat a little bit better than they were normally had. The food was very strict, tough over there. No candy or sugars or anything like that, and. You just felt embarrassed if you wasted a mouthful of food. In fact, I still have trouble seeing people waste food. One woman we got to know, her name was Erica Winterbotham. And she lived in a rather nice house I think it was Coberly. It was not too far from the hospital. And one time she had 3 of us over there to dinner and had some meat. Which she said apparently she had knew somebody who knew somebody, and she was able to get some meat, which was a big deal to have some meat like that. She was a very aristocratic woman, and I think, you know, she was probably a little higher class than some of the other people. She tried to, you know, she syndicated as much. However, I think they all enjoyed their association with us and the ability to come out to the hospital and talk with the patients and help the patients, and they would mend for the patients. Of course, we had the English girls, the young English girls who would come out to the dances. And
dance with the American boys.
Dance with the American boys, yes. Then we had...
Did they come on their own, or were they
We picked them up by bus. Took them back to the downtown.
Uh-huh.
And because we needed to have control over
understand
over
this.
There was one, I remember one medical officer who got really involved with somebody in town, and, you know, nice married man, but he became very involved with this older woman downtown, and, you know, just took her, made her his wife, and she made him her husband, and often wondered what happened to them after that, because he would bring her out to the post and to the parties and officers' parties. And
this
so
is
forth.
An American. You were talking about this man who accepted an English lady
yes.
as a mistress.
Well, that was typical. Even the commanding officer, I think, did that. The commanding officer got himself in trouble because he built a hut for himself out of
army supplies,
and it was recognized. You could recognize he was an oddball, and I understand later that he was court-martialed for doing that. He didn't add much to the unit. I mean, the unit was had to more or less do its good work in spite of him. Mm-hmm. We had an adjutant, and the adjutant was a good friend of ours, Colonel Gould. They had the executive officer, and he also had his nurse girlfriend. It was impossible, in a way, to not to form close friendships and pairs and pair off with people. Mm-hmm. I made an effort not to go with any married men because I figured not only did I feel it wasn't right, I didn't want to get myself hurt. I didn't want to fall in love with somebody that was married and discover, right. I had to separate from him. So I really made myself that rule. However, it doesn't mean that I didn't go with married men. They just didn't tell you that they...
We often went with them in groups. This was very common.
Well,
or even to a dance.
I went with them not knowing they were married, you know.
Mm-hmm,
they didn't
right.
know. They didn't know. They didn't tell you they were married. They just mm-hmm. indicated that they weren't. So I can understand some of these men had been would transfer into our unit, and they'd been overseas for 2 or 3 years. Well,
mm-hmm.
That's a long time, and
right.
and eventually time erodes a lot of things, and they would become particular friends. And I had, because I had worked for almost 8 years in a hospital before I joined Red Cross,
mm-hmm.
I knew how easy it was to make platonic friendships.
Right.
You make friendships with people not because you work with them, because you have interests
mm-hmm.
in common. So that was an interesting.
You mentioned that this English lady, meat was a rarity. What do you mean by a rarity there, do you think she would have meat once every 2 weeks?
Oh, heavens no.
Oh, you mean
wouldn't
once
have
a month?
It, period.
Oh, she wouldn't have meat, period.
I don't think the people could get meat more than once a month, I think.
Once
they
a month would have been a real treat. And then the meat would have been lamb or something of this nature,
I think this was beef.
Beef.
Was beef.
Mm-hmm.
I guess another thing I mentioned with that we recreation workers did was take ambulatory patients to places like Stratford-on-Avon. I took a number of groups to Stratford-on-Avon.
The theater?
Yes, the theater and the ground.
Did you see
the city.
A Shakespeare play?
We saw one Shakespeare play.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and another wonderful thing I did. It was in June in 1945, after the war was over. I went on what was called a leave course at Oxford University.
Mm-hmm.
At Balliol College at Oxford, they had a leave course for a week, and you went there, and you had classes on international relations and all. And I was the only American, and there were people from Australia, New Zealand, and Poland, and England. And I made a particularly good friend of an English man, English boy, I suppose he was. I never did figure out how old he was, and we wrote for a long time after the war. I wrote. His name was Gordon Kenshaw. And I think he was teaching at the University of London, a brilliant fellow. I was invited to, first night we got there, we had a tea at Rhodes House, Rhodes Scholar's House, Rhodes House, and went over there and I met two boys came up and asked if they could, I'd like to go with them, and I went with them, and it developed that they had been prisoners of war in Germany, and this one handsome young fellow, who was, his name was Duncan Black, had only been out of the prison camp for about a week, and he was just so delighted to have somebody to talk to, and was telling about his experiences in the camp. And, So I really enjoyed this week at Oxford. I always felt that I could say I'd been to Oxford.
Oxford University.
You know, it was Balliol College, and we lived in the quadrant. We each had our room. I lived in staircase number 10. And we ate, our meals were in the big hall, they call it the hall, and we sat at long tables just like of course it is one of the well-known colleges at the university.
Katie, did you notice any particular casualties over there? Tell us about some of the memorable instances of people who were sent, they were sent to England, weren't they, from Europe?
Yes, we would get them from, I suppose, the evacuation hospital, and then we would
from what evacuation?
From any evacuation hospital.
In the European theater.
Yes, mm-hmm.
Right.
And they would come. They had all kinds of things wrong with them. We referred to them as the fellow with the leg and the fellow with the arm, and that's the way you kind of identified them. If you couldn't remember their name.
Mm-hmm.
I particularly remember the fellows that had frostbitten feet. They put them all in the same ward, and they were. You'd look down the ward, and you could see. They didn't cover. They just covered their from the waist to their mm-hmm. maybe their knees, and all these feet sticking up on pillows. You know, all the way down the ward, and it was really kind of amazing sight. And they were frostbitten. They had the frozen
feet.
What
was the big push in Europe in? Let's see, this is the second half of 1944.
Well, in December, when they had the Battle of the Bulge, before that, we had had a unit come over. It was fairly close to us. I think it was the 26th Infantry Division, or 126, something like that, fresh from the States, and they were sent right to the Battle of the Bulge. And undoubtedly, a lot of them never made it.
Was their morale? What was their attitude? What did they do?
I don't remember too much about the morale. That was your job. You just.
Uh-huh.
I don't remember that people. Certainly, people weren't malingerers.
They weren't crybabies.
No. They, and they just had done. You know, they were in
this
the army.
This is what they had to do,
yeah.
And they did
mm-hmm.
it.
Yeah, they're very well disciplined. Very highly disciplined. I remember one particular patient whose name was Buell Doddrill, and he was blind. Handsome young guy.
He had been blinded in the war?
He had been blinded by a concussion in a half track.
Mm-hmm.
And I really tried, you know, spent quite a bit of time with him and even wrote to him after he came back, and he went to, I think it was Valley Forge General Hospital where all the blind fellows went, and later mm-hmm. he wrote and said, well, he got married, and so I suppose he's happy. I hope he is. And then another fellow I remember was a about one of the most ill patients we had. He had some kind of kidney problem, I think. He had been shot in the kidneys. And everybody was pulling for him, and they were working on him so hard to get him well enough to send back to the States, because his family was desperately waiting for him. And he was seemingly getting better, and they thought, well, they'll just wait a little bit longer to send him back so that he'll really be stronger. And lo and behold, he started getting worse and died. And he is about the only patient I can remember that died in our hospital. If they were seriously ill, apparently they were sent back to the United States as soon as possible.
Katie, how long did you stay overseas?
I was over there almost exactly a year.
One year.
We landed on the 4th of July, and it was the next July when we were to come back.
You were there then during VE Day, weren't you?
Yes.
What was that like?
Well, it really, I'll have to say, it wasn't very big. I so happened that I had gone to London to meet Janet, who had come back from France and was there for a little while, and we were in London the night of VE Day, and expecting great celebrations, and somehow we just missed out on everything. We didn't get in with a group that was celebrating, and we walked around the streets some, but it was one of those situations where we were separated from our usual group, And we were not invited to any particular parties, and it was really not as exciting a part of part as you would event as you would expect it to be. I mean, I'm speaking from VE. Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, VE Day happened, and then of course we realized that our unit was going to be going back to the States and regroup and go to the Pacific because the war in Europe.
So the people of England didn't really whoop it up, did they?
Well, they probably did. It was just that I myself was not.
Mm-hmm. And
did
you
not
involve. Out where you
I
could see the celebrating.
I wasn't with a group that was celebrating.
Mm-hmm.
We were in London, and if we'd been back at home, why, of course, we would have, you know, been different. I do remember, though, that I marched in the victory parade through Cheltenham, and that was exciting. They had, a week or two later, they had a parade.
When was this victory parade?
Well, it was after VE
Day.
After VE Day, yes,
that
before,
week after.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And before we headed for home. But we got it all packed up, and by this time, Janet and Helen had gone. Our five Red Cross girls had broken up. So I should, at that point, have separated and gone over to the continent too. But I didn't. I wanted to stay with this unit. So I came back home, and of course we had. I've forgotten where we went. Somewhere for a week or two, and got separated from Red Cross and separated from the unit. Went home, and. While I was home, they dropped the atomic bomb, and war was over. So the end of my career at the Red Cross was kind of anticlimactic, yes, because I never went back. After that, I separated from Red Cross.
When did you separate? What date?
I don't
roughly.
Remember.
Do you know what
well, it
month?
Was probably September.
September after the VJ Day.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then I came back home to my mother and dad's house, home in Eaton Rapids, which because I didn't have a home other than that, and got a job at Sparrow Hospital in Lansing and in the laboratory.
Did you find any traumatic change in coming back to the States?
Well, I could have been. After all, when you're over there, you're an American girl in England with
uh-huh.
You or something very pretty special. Well, when I got back here, I was just a plain old American girl, and after all, by that time, I was well into my 20s, and I didn't have my boyfriends were all throughout the United States, and
uh-huh.
So I more or less I was starting from scratch again. I changed my location, I got a job at Sparrow Hospital and worked there for about a year or so, and met George Kerr,
mm-hmm.
who was a state policeman. And actually, he came. We had in the laboratory. We always used the state policemen as professional blood donors, and they got $25 a pint for their blood because that was before the days of the Red Cross blood banks. And George took me out to help him spend part of his $25, and I married him. So that was a good ending, at least.
VJ Day was a very traumatic experience for me. Was it for you?
VJ Day. Well,
I mean the dropping of the
atom
bomb in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Well, you see, I had a concept of the atom
uh-huh,
and the power of it
mm-hmm.
because I had been through a cyclotron at the University of Michigan in 1941.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember my mind really whirling.
Mm-hmm.
I listened
mm-hmm.
to every word on the radio,
mm-hmm.
and I was aware of the total power that
mm-hmm.
could be released.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think many of us did not have that concept. Where I learned about it, I had gone to Detroit to. It was during the time I was home to visit a friend in Detroit, and I was riding down Woodard Avenue in a streetcar. When either I heard it on the radio or read it in the paper, you know, it was rather an odd way to learn about it. But then, of course, that really changed everything. When they dropped the bomb, it changed everything, changed many people's lives. And of course, if we had gone, I am convinced that if we had tried to invade Japan, the casualties would have just been absolutely
yes.
terrible.
I can imagine that. Every Japanese would have committed harikari before they
yes.
would have allowed
yes.
an American to live. I mean,
yes. mm-hmm.
thank you, Katie. Then is that it?
Stop it. There's one thing I would like to say about Red Cross. I feel that I've been fighting the battle of Red Cross ever since I joined in 1944. Red Cross did a tremendous job over there. And of course, you probably heard that people bought cigarettes, Red Cross sold cigarettes, and so forth and so forth. I will categorically say I never, never sold a pack of cigarettes, but I gave hundreds, perhaps even thousands of them away. I gave away toothpaste and toothbrushes and soap and candy bars and many, many, many things like that. Also, as I mentioned before, we loaned the servicemen money. A neighbor of mine said that her husband was with Patton's Army, and when their child was born, Red Cross did not get the message to her husband that their son was born. And I certainly told her that if the Army couldn't keep up with Patton, I certainly didn't see how the Red Cross could. I think many people had a very strange concept that Red Cross had some way to get messages through that nobody else had, and after all, we did use the military service wires.
Our family experienced the Red Cross getting a message through when Mother was dying. Of course, this was in 1949, but the only way we could get a message to my brother, who was up in pulling American supplies out of Shanghai.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
The Red Cross got through to him for us.
Yes. Well, they could use the Army of telex, but they didn't have any other method, such as a secret radio signal or something like that. And in signing off, I should sign off with my Red Cross number, which was 39343. Which is equivalent to the Army numbers that everybody learned and would never in all their life forget. This is Catherine Kerr, Catherine Trimble Kerr, 39343, American Red Cross.
Thank you, Catherine.